Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, tonight we're going to hear about some of the most extraordinary rock and cave art that exists across the globe. Essentially, rock art's the most important visual record of humanity's past, and it's found everywhere on every continent, except Antarctica, for obvious reasons, perhaps. How do we actually define rock art? Can be paintings, drawings, engravings, stencils, figures made of beeswax in rock shelters and caves. In our own country, Australia, there are more than 100,000 significant rock art sites. And Aboriginal rock art's been dated to at least 30,000 years ago. Although there are possibly much older sites that haven't yet been discovered. Outside of Australia, archaeologists discovered the world's oldest known cave painting, made at least 45,500 years ago in Indonesia just last year. The work was painted using dark red ochre pigment. It's a life-sized picture of what's called the Sulawesi Warty Pig. Google it, by the way, the Sulawesi Warty Pig. The picture is just magnificent. Anyway, joining us tonight to explore the wonderful world of rock and cave art is Griffith University's Chair in Rock Art Research, Professor Paul Tayson. Paul, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us, Senior Archaeologist Dan Gamelroy and Blue Mountains Community Member Wayne Brennan. Wayne, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Phil.
Terrific to have you here in the studio. Also joining us, Joe McDonald, Director of the Centre for Rock Art Research and Management at the University of Western Australia. Joe, good evening to you and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Can we start at the beginning? Paul, when did you first see and were moved by rock art? What was it?
Oh, actually, it was when I was about 10 years old in Spain. My family was in Europe for a couple of years. My father was on sabbatical, and we went into some rock shelters with these amazing paintings of human figures hunting deer. And I remember standing in front of them, thinking, wow, my father's an artist, my grandfather's an artist, but the artist who made these paintings made them thousands of years ago. And I've had an interest in rock art ever since.
Yeah, you would have heard from your accent, of course, that you weren't born here in Canada, I understand. How did you wash up in Australia?
Well, it's a long story that involves a kangaroo, among other things. I saw Skippy the Bush Kangaroo on TV, and I thought, wow, what an amazing animal, what an amazing country. And then when I was in high school, grade 10 geography class, we studied Australia for a third of the year, and I was hooked. So when I did my undergraduate degree in anthropology and psychology, I decided that I wanted to visit Australia. And in 1981, got here and was very fortunate to work with the late Rhys Jones up in Kakadu National Park.
Oh, yeah.
Where there were amazing rock paintings. And I've been working in Kakadu ever since. Actually, this is my 40th anniversary of working in the Kakadu Arnhem Land area. Mm.
Is that the most significant place in Australia, do you think, for Indigenous rock art in Australia?
It's one of many. Australia has remarkable sites from one end of the country to the other. Although there is a large concentration in Western Arnhem Land, but also in the Kimberley, in far north Queensland, in the Pilbara, where Joe works, and even the greater Sydney area, the Sydney Basin has lots of very significant rock art.
Hmm. Joe, tell me about your first experience. What did you first see and why were you moved by it?
Well, I think I grew up in Cronulla and did a lot of bushwalking in Royal National Park and had absolutely no idea that there was rock art there at that time. And it was when I got to uni that I was lucky enough to have a lecturer called John Clegg, who was very excited and interested in rock art. And he took us out, I think it was in our second year, to look at some cave paintings up north of Sydney. And I was pretty much hooked then as well. So bit later, of a later starter than Paul, but I think once you actually see rock art in its context and you actually begin to actually understand the antiquity and the fact that it's been, you know, the signs of people that have been there for through time and much, much earlier than you've been there, that you just get such a strong feeling about, you know, what that must mean.
Yeah, it's the continuity of it. I remember myself, I'll tell you the first one that I saw too. I think west of Cobar in New South Wales. There's a site there. And I remember seeing it and just being, because there's nothing else there. There's just country. And here is this rock overhang, beautiful in a way, in lots of ways too. And you can see why it would have been used as a shelter. And here are these paintings and drawings and all sorts of things on the rock, and it just, for an overwhelming moment, gave me this sense of continuity in the land, because I thought when I looked at it, oh, this must be very, very, very old. It's not very, very old. In other words, people have been doing this in this land for ever, pretty much. Yeah, we'll talk about dating it in a moment, Joe, because that's important too. But let's bring in Wayne too, senior archaeologist, Gamilaroi and Blue Mountains man, Wayne Brennan. And Brain, tell me about your background and how you got into working, because you've been working with Paul too, haven't you?
Over 20 years, and it's quite interesting to hear their stories actually, and it's quite evocative rock art. And my story is, I was over in America. I was on a scholarship in 1975. I went over with my identical twin on an athletic scholarship, actually. We were over there. We were 1,500 meter runners. And I was up in Pueblo country, up in New Mexico. And we were excavating a site there. It was a building. And I happened to go up there that weekend we had off, and some of the local Native Americans took me up there and showed me this site, and I was hooked. I just fell in love with rock art and fell in with the concept of country too. And when I came back to Australia, I moved to the Blue Mountains. I started to walk around that country and get really familiar with it, because it's had a lot of sandstone country. And that's how I met up with Paul. Paul was at the museum in 2000, and we did some work in the Wollamai over the last 20 years we've been working.
Yeah, you've been working in the Wollamai National Park. Now, this program's going everywhere in Australia. You better explain to me where the Wollamai is.
Well, the Wollamai is just northwest of Sydney. It's within 100
kilometres. In the Blue Mountains.
Yes, indeed. It's in the Greater Blue Mountains World Heritage Area. It's in the northern part. It's about 650,000 hectares, which is about half the size of the World Heritage Area. World Heritage is about 1.2. And it's pristine wilderness area. And
it's where they discovered the Wollamai pine.
Area. Well, it's in that big area, yeah. We can't talk much about it. I actually worked with the Park Service for over 30 years, actually, in the Blue Mountains region. Part of my job was to work with cultural heritage. So it brings you in. But the important thing, it's not just the art. It's where it is. And I think Paul would agree with me and Joe that it's the people that you work with too is also draws you in. It's like stepping into someone's lounge room and you're sitting there and maybe Paul and Joe could actually put a little bit more spin on that, but I found it was quite, it affected me quite deeply. And when I got back to Australia, I was seeking rock art out, and I became culturally too for me. My work with people in my community in the Blue Mountains, as well as my Gamilaroi mentors, it was very important for me to continue on with my work. They made that very clear, and it still is today.
In the mid-90s, Wayne, a group of bushwalkers in the Wollamai stumbled upon a cave that was brimming with art. It was a very significant discovery.
Yeah, it was.
So tell me about it.
It was, in a sense, because... it was in wild country, and look, a lot of people have done work in this area, McCarthy and actually Joe had done a lot of work in the Sydney Basin, but we were quite excited about it because of the nature of the drawings and paintings, and also the subject matter. It had some incredibly well-drawn figures, as well as it had a whole platitude of animals and things that were just incredible. You know, and I think both Paul and I, we were there together when we first saw the site. It just blew our socks off. I think the only other site for me is the site up there in Arnhem Land, because I have worked a little bit up there with Paul about four or five seasons, is the site of Jaliri, which gave me the similar feeling. It just affects you deeply. It changed my life. Tell me why it changed your life.
When you say it affected you deeply, obviously with your own Indigenous heritage, you feel a connection to it, do you? Or is it something else?
Definitely. But it also is the workmanship and the just the connection that people had with the art, both the past ancestors, but the incredible, not just the beauty, but it invokes you to really bring out what's happening in you personally too. It's not just a, I could imagine there being there on site as a group, but also too individually you would get affected, obviously. But for me, it went deeper. It made me realise the expansiveness of the knowledge that was still there. And it made me actually realise the importance of involving Aboriginal people in our work, right through, but more importantly, how we work with scientists. And I had a really early appreciation of that because, as my Native American friends would say, you know, we have to have our young men with their legs in both camps. And I think that's why I work so well with Paul, is that he understood how it worked. And he works really well with Aboriginal people, and both with groups and individuals. And that appealed to me. So I think it was a real important for me to meet up with Paul because he gave me the energy, the impetus to keep going with what I was doing.
Mm.
Yeah,
Paul.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Wayne Brennan's with us, a senior archaeologist and Blue Mountains community member, Gamilaroi man. Joe McDonald's with us too, director of the Centre for Rock Art Research at UWA, and Professor Paul Tayson from Griffith University. Paul, what's going on with rock art? Because it seems common around the world to almost all Homo sapiens cultures. What's going on? What's it about?
It's about lots of things. Certainly, there's often powerful aesthetics. It's about communicating things between people and across generations. It's about connections between people. In First Nations, Australians talk about connections to direct ancestors. Sometimes we know the individuals who made rock art, rock art of the past 100 years. But it's also a place where you can connect to ancestral beings who made that landscape where the rock art sites are found, or where there are depictions of those ancestral heroes. It's also a place where nature and culture comes together, because of course these are wonderful natural landscapes, but by adding the rock art, they also become cultural places. And for many groups of people around the world, rock art still has contemporary importance, and it's a place where you can tell and relate cultural stories. We believe that was one of the reasons, or one of the ways rock art sites were used in the past, but certainly they are today by many groups of people in different parts of the world. And in Australia, First Nations Australians right across the country say that rock art is a part of contemporary culture, contemporary living Aboriginal culture, and that it's related to their contemporary well-being. And this is why we need to better look after these places, because if they're harmed or damaged, that can have a very negative effect on well-being.
Wayne, when you see rock art, you say it can bring up a lot of grief.
Well, it does.
The emotions
are
mixed.
You can flick between the two, and I work a lot with different people, and that's come up a lot of times when we've actually showed the art, is a lot of grief comes up. And I think it has to do with that there's this feeling that it's finished, that it's done. Now, I think it's really important to explain, for me, the revival of rock art is actually not just reproducing it. It's about discussion, and this is what we've been doing with our elders in this area. We've been taking people in where they can go in, or we've been showing images. And Paul and I have been doing this for a long while, both in Arnhem Land as well as mainly in the Wollamai. And it's really incredible for people to actually see the art and to discuss it, because that's the part that's the revival part.
Yeah.
That is the discussion of rock art.
Yeah, it's still being practiced, isn't it?
Indeed,
sorry to interrupt you, but we kind of get this idea that when we see Aboriginal rock art in Australia, oh, this was something that was done 50,000 years ago, but that's not true, is it?
No, it's still happening. The images and designs are still very. Very much a part, story, song, dance, and art is part of cultural heritage for Aboriginal people. It's a way of expressing and getting across the narrative. And the narrative is really important rock art, particularly the engravings, because the ancestral creational beings who created the landscape, they're in the story. So we have a saying, the story's in the landscape's in the story. And if you don't know the story of the landscape, you're going to get horribly lost, both spiritually and physically. And you don't want to do that.
I like that. Joe, can I bring you in here? Archaeology itself is a fascinating science in the way it's developed too, and the rigor that it's learned to bring to bear on these issues. I mean, it was quite difficult, wasn't it, up until, I think, till the 1950s when there was a couple of technological breakthroughs. It was quite difficult to actually date rock art. You could look at it and think it looks old, but dating it was difficult, wasn't it? Explain the dating process.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. I think that is one of the fundamental things about the way that archaeology has developed, certainly in the last 50 years, is that with the understanding that you could age radiocarbon, date carbon, by the way, it decays through time, suddenly we had this capacity to actually date charcoal in fires and organics that you can find in sites. And so it was really unknown at that stage how old and how long Aboriginal people had been living in this country. And so when John Mulvaney, I think it was, got the first date of about 7,000 years in the 60s, and then a couple of years later it was 12,000 years, and then by the time I was at uni in the late 70s, Mungo had been dated to 40,000 years ago. So, that's an extraordinary trajectory in terms of our knowledge about how long people have been on this continent. It's beginning to approximate, the Aboriginal ontological view that they've always been here. I mean, they've been here for so long that it is. They have always been here. And the techniques are continuing to evolve. So we now use OSL as well as radiocarbon because radiocarbon actually stops being useful at 50,000 years ago, which is, of course, a critical time, we think, in the actual trajectory of understanding when people arrived here, because we have somewhere between...
Why is it run out at 50,000? Because that's when the half-life of these things finishes, isn't it?
That's right. The half-life is 4,500 years, so therefore, therefore, something that died 50,000 years ago will have virtually no carbon left in it.
To measure. There are some techniques now, aren't there, that allow you to go older than 50,000 years?
Yeah, uranium series is what people are now using, which is cutting off that difference, but also OSL, so optically stimulated luminescence, which is basically grains of sand get excited by the sun, and as soon as they get covered up, they start discharging. The clock starts and you can actually count how long they've been covered up. So again, people are dating sand deposits. There's one site, the site that's been dated to 65,000 years in Kakadu has been dated by OSL.
That's not an art site, is it? That's a habitation site.
It does have art in it, but we don't have the art that's dated to 65,000. We only have the archaeology at this point.
It keeps getting pushed back, doesn't it?
Well,
yeah, it does.
The funny thing about that particular site, Ledger Baby, is that the deposit goes all the way back to about 65,000 years ago. And that is just below a panel with wonderful paintings. But all of the paintings that are on that panel were made in just the last 3,000 or 4,000 years. There are older paintings in the landscape nearby. And there may be older paintings that have been covered over by the recent one. But there is that contrast between the dates in the deposit and the types of paintings that are above it. And we see that in many shelters.
That's what makes it interesting. Anomalies make it interesting, actually. Yeah, really.
In Mudger Baby, Paul, the basal deposit's, 2 metres below the current surface?
Over 2 metres, that's correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, it actually would have been covered up, all the earlier art, when people were actually living on that earlier land surface. I don't think the whole wall has been exposed, has it, down to that age?
A significant part of it is, but nothing remains on that part of the wall because it's been covered for so long.
Do we know about most of the sites, or sorry, do we know about the art that survived in Australia now, or do you think that there's still a lot of art out there that we haven't seen yet?
There's more.
I think we'd all agree there's lots more. You know, it's really interesting, you know, the conversations that we have as archaeologists, particularly as rock art specialists, is we get asked those two questions, how old is it and what is it? And they're probably the two most difficult questions most of the time to answer. So I've sort of given up on truth. I just manage viewpoints. And it seems to work for me.
I'm very interested in the what, though, because the what is puzzling is that you look at a lot of, and you think, what story is being told here? Maybe no one knows.
Well, we don't know. This is the interesting part of it, particularly say I could focus on the Waller Mine, say with the arm there. Now, we found over 200 sites in the last since about 2001. We're still finding sites. And some of them are really important sites that we had no idea, like a new engraving at Mount Victoria that has two types of technique in it. So I would say definitely there are other sites out there, in particularly in the Wollamai. Now, of course, we've had our big fires. This is the time to go in. And this is part of what we're doing now with the project with the Australian Museum. And this is what Paul and I did, didn't we, Paul, in 2001. We repeated that experiment. See, fire does affect rock art. But what we've found out just recently, since we've been scurrying around after these latest fires, those old men knew where to put the art. They know where to put the pigment art. I think our greatest risk from my perspective in the Wollamai, in the sandstone country, are our sandstone platforms. They're the ones that I think are most vulnerable because they're usually in high flat areas, rich tops, which are always vulnerable to fire. Whereas the shelters, they will burn, particularly when the air gets superheated from the fire, and then if there's any moisture in the back of the shelter, that will delaminate the shelter. But most of the shelters we've looked at recently in the Wollamai after these massive fires, most of them have survived. The fire's gone out. Particularly some of the like Eagles Reach, which is the main shelter there, the fire burned up there so hot, we had a look at it, and then it just went out. There was this big platform. So I think that there is a strategic approach to where the rock art is placed in the landscape, but there's a more important part where it relates to other features in the landscape. So if people ask me, is there a set formula? Yes, certain pigment art will obviously get found in shelters, whereas engravings are up on these flatter platforms. Not always, but that's generally where they are. And I believe there is a certain particular function about engravings, but I'm still not finished with that sort of research.
Go on. What is that?
Well, I think that they talk a lot about big country in the Wollamai. Right. They're generally about stories about ancestral men, and they're connected with the Burbung ceremony. So there's two ceremonies that are performed in New South Wales around this area, the two main ones. The Burbung is what we deal with in the Blue Mountains mainly and in the North Coast, and goes all the way up through to Queensland. And so I think that's all locked in with the engravings, the way that they're set out. They'd also have earth sculptures as well. So it's not just the engravings that are part of that feature or ceremony. There's lots of other things happening off that. Whereas, you know, maybe the pigment art's more the fine tuning of the story. I don't know. You know? we could get into some contentious things here, but the fact is, getting back to your original question, there is still a lot more art to be recorded. And that is the best way to protect it, Phil, is to actually get good records. And I think Joe and Paul would agree with me on that.
Yeah, I want to get to that point in a moment. Let's talk some more about the images themselves. Paul, what are they constructed with? I mean, Wayne's using the term pigment and so on. What materials are used here? Perhaps Joe, you can join this conversation too. Paul?
It's quite a limited range of material, mostly ochres, red hematite, for instance, yellow limonite, yellow also is heated up or burnt to turn into red, white pipe clay. Sometimes charcoal or manganese is used to make black.
And mixtures of fixtures too. I think the formulas are very interesting. There's been a couple of studies done on trying to assign particular formulas to particular groups, but it's very difficult. I mean, it changes over time. But we know that certain things were used in body paint, for example.
Yeah.
But we don't know much about the chemical formulas of some of the ochres. We know that if you just put ochre as a hand stencil on a rock shelter in the Blue Mountains, it'll be gone in 2 months.
See, this is what, that's right. I wanted to ask you about this because these things have lasted for 50,000 years, perhaps. Well, let's say about what we know, 30,000 years at least in the open air. I mean, okay, they're on rock overhangs and sometimes in caves, but, you know, they're exposed to the open air, as it were. Joe, do we know anything about why they've managed to last that long?
Well, there have been some really good studies recently done in the Kimberley that have actually explored this, and it appears that there's a sort of bonding between the hematite, mainly red, that has survived that long, and the underlying geology. So the sandstone is nice and fine-grained. But there's also a whole series of processes where, in fact, they're like geochemical and biochemical reactions, which in fact form a slight film over the top, sort of sealing these things in. Mm-hmm. So it does seem to be a magic combination of good fortune, if you like, of geological selection of pigments that have lasted. It probably is a case of people using binders, which have actually made sure that they adhere to the surface long enough for them to bind with the actual surface.
Mm.
But the extraordinary thing is when you compare the rock art in Australia to the sites in France, for instance, which are kilometres up underground, you know, for them to have survived. I mean, obviously Chauvet is dated to, you mentioned before, 36,000 years ago, but that is sealed in a cave which was only discovered in the last 30 or so years. And so it's been actually sealed hermetically, under the ground for that long, and you can understand something that long lasting. But the fact that the Australian material actually does survive, engravings are everywhere also.
Exactly, I can't imagine Western oil paint surviving for 30,000 years.
Well, it's a great question, Phil.
It's interesting you say that, though, because we did in fact discover in some of the Western desert art we're looking at that it had that a lot of these motifs had titanium in them. Right. We thought when we actually used the PXRs that, in fact, people had used house paint. We just said, oh, my God, these must be graffiti. And then we realised when we actually used the PXRF machine on other traditional motifs that, in fact, there was a high level of titanium in the white pigment. Yeah. So, in fact, it's almost as if this has been, a discovery made very early by the Aboriginal people, the Madu, in this particular instance, using a pigment that's actually having a longevity. I mean, titanium is added to paint to make it last longer on the walls and resist the sun. So pretty amazing, really.
It is amazing. We're talking about rock art, particularly in Australia. Joe McDonald, who you just heard speaking, is Director of the Centre for Rock Art Research at UWA, Professor Paul Tasson from Griffith University, and Wayne Brennan, Senior archaeologist and Gamilaroi man from the Blue Mountains, and did a lot of work in the Wollamai, is also with us. Paul, what's with the stencils of the human hand? What are these found everywhere around the world? Is it just in Australia? And what's going on there? Why did people do this?
They're found in different concentrations in different parts of the world. Hand stencils are actually quite rare in most of Africa. There are a few locations in northern Africa. They're found in the oldest art of Europe, some of the very old art of the Americas, and certainly the oldest in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, in Sulawesi and Kalimantan. Stencils have been dated to at least 40,000 years ago. These are hands as well as hands with forearms. And then they run right through rock art sequences across Australia. In some ways, Australia can be considered the stencil capital of the world because there are more hand stencils and other sorts of stencils here than in any other country.
Why?
Well, certainly they are the oldest surviving forms of art in parts of Western Arnhem Land. And then they were made up until a few years ago, and probably some people are still making them today. And I think part of the reason they're so common and they run through sequences is it's a direct way to connect with the site. The human hand is a key feature of ourselves. We do so much with our hands. And if it weren't for our hands, we wouldn't be able to survive.
Mm.
But the hand also is a way of saying, I was here, this is my place, this is my country. And for Aboriginal people who made hand census recently, they're now quite elderly, the ones that I've worked with in Northern Land, that's exactly what they said, that it was a way of them saying, I was here, this is a part of my country.
Yeah.
So it's a way to connect to those places and the power within those sites and landscapes.
Yeah. Wayne, what are your thoughts on it? Are the stencil capital, the hand stencil capital of the world. Is it about marking the spot, saying, because there are children's hands. Well, not just adults' hands, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And I think that Paul's, you know, the stencils that we've looked at in the Wollamai, in actual fact, I think the bottom layer of the there's 12 different layers at Eagles Reach.
Mm.
I think it was red hand stencils, wasn't it, Paul? If I remember
right,
yeah. And so it's, but even like when we did this crossing of Wollamai about 10 years ago with a group of young Aboriginal men, we stopped at different rock art sites. There's one of them that wanted to put a hand stencil in, and there was debate about whether it should be done, and I just listened to the debate, and in the end, everybody that had been through some sort of law had to leave this hand stencil, but they decided they'd just do it in ochre because they thought, oh, well, this is, you know, maybe not the right thing, but we want to do it, and we'll see what happens. So we went back there another 6 months later, and it had gone. But the discussion was about leaving their mark, and also the discussion revolved around even the collar and whether someone should put the forearm in. So that was the more important part to me, was the discussion about it, not the actual event. The event happened. But for me, it is exactly what Paul, it's recognition of I've been here, and you would come back, no doubt, and say, well, look, I left my hand stencil here. There's my two kids. Now they're much bigger hands, you know, so maybe they'd leave another hand stencil. But it's really interesting because there's these clusters in the Wollamai that I've noticed where you just have a shelter that's all it's got, is nothing but stencils. And so,
one of the great things about stencils is they were made by everyone in the family.
Yes.
Men, women, and children. Even babies' hands and feet were stenciled.
Mm.
One of my favorite sites in central Arnhem Land is a shelter that is about 1.8 meters high. And in the middle of the ceiling are two tiny baby foot stencils. And you can just imagine this poor baby held upside down.
Hang on, it's been held upside down on the floor, on the roof of a cave.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's really connecting the country, isn't it? I mean, it's quite fascinating when you come across a group of those things. It's just this feeling that there's still this energy there.
Yeah.
I think that it's,
Wayne, you've been taking groups of young Indigenous men to see some of this art.
Yes.
What Because one of the things that struck me was the sense of continuity of the art that's thousands of years old and the art that's quite recent.
Yes,
there's a direct line that you can see through it. So when young Indigenous people see these images, what do they say about them?
They're quite overwhelmed. I remember when we took Malian in there, and it was very emotional for him, and he felt a deep sadness as well. It was a sadness because that era had gone, that there was no more people left to come back here and do what needed to be done. But that turned around.
Mm.
You know, I think contemporary Aboriginal viewpoint is so important to our work. And I think Joe and Paul would agree with me on that note. And they work very well together with Aboriginal, and you can't do it any other way. And it's a gentle thing that you've got, but sometimes it can be brutal too. For some people, they get upset, and sometimes you have to deal with that. But generally, there's a uplifting once you connect, and I could say that for most of the time, most of the sites that I go to, there's generally an uplifting. And I think that most of the young men that experienced that trip, a lot of them hadn't been even in the bush that much. Some of them had, and it changed some of their lives, in actual fact. It changed some of their lives.
Yeah, on a deep level.
Well, they became much more passionate, much more interested in rock art, but more importantly, their own identity and who they were and how they wanted to actually keep the stories alive. A lot of them ended up working with me in the park service, actually, as guides. not taking necessarily people to rock art, but learning how to convey the culture, to actually interpret the culture and make it work for non-Aboriginal people as well as Aboriginal people. And that can be difficult.
Can be, can it, Joe? Because I think in the West, say, you know, we would go to the great art galleries and look at, well, hardly 50,000 years, but hundreds of years of art and recognise those stories that are being told there and therefore get some sense of that continuity. This is the same thing, isn't it? It's just finding the stories to tell, is it?
Well, I think, I mean, the interesting thing working in the Western Desert is that dreaming mythologies, which link up known water sources and which are connected across the desert and which tell stories of the ancestral beings coming and forming the landscape. You can see by looking at the art that, in fact, you have people in different eras coming back to those same water holes. And from the imagery that's there, it suggests that, in fact, people are curating the same sorts of stories. So you can actually see this recursive use of place and the recursive use of rock art to actually tell a story at that place. And if you know the mythology, you can actually even see the art which reflects those particular stories. So, you know, as a mythology and a mythological being moves across the landscape and does various things, often the rock art which you find in those locations will be showing that story. And certainly if you go back with Aboriginal people today, they know the story for that place and they will be able to actually interpret what element of the assemblage. And there might be hundreds of motifs in a site, but that particular story will be depicted by a particular motif in that site.
Okay, that's interesting.
Draw that out and go, this is
And that's part of you know, the elders would, in a sense, you draw the story out.
Is that common that way? Because I hadn't realised that, and that's an interesting point that can you go to country that you would know about, for example, and see the stories of your country in the rock art?
It depends on what cultural knowledge you have, Phil. I mean, that's the beautiful thing. Yeah. And what happens with once you get one story, you get the passion for another, I'm sure. One of the interesting things that I learned from working with a lot of different groups is that some of these people really know, they recognise the ancestral beings in the rock art. Okay. And they may be slightly different for example, gender, they might have but that's what gives them their identity, is their explanation of what they're looking at. And so when you go into country, and Paul and I have experienced this a lot, we'll get a couple of different versions. And, you know, a couple of my co-workers are Graham King. Now, we actually get concerned if there's not more than three or four stories about this, or slightly different. And the narratives is important, and the narrative can be linked up. And what for Gamilaroi men, we would never own all that story. We would only own part of that story. And generally it was in four sections. So when you married those stories up, see, this is the thing about truth. You couldn't change that story generally because it wouldn't marry up. And you're only responsible for telling part of that story. So you had to marry it up with the next one. And if someone couldn't actually fulfill that obligation, then the Takiti man, as we call him, would come in and teach that story. And until that story was known, then he would help that person tell that story, and then it'd be completed again. Now, that's really important because that keeps the integrity. And I think that's really important for all of Aboriginal people, is to keep the integrity. And the best way to do that is not make it up. Mm-hmm. And how do we know things aren't being made up? That's it. You know, how do we know? Well, just you can look at our federal government how do we know they don't make up things? Well, they do. And some people do. But eventually you get to know the gammon stories. Yeah.
What are the issues of preservation? I wanted to ask you, Paul, too. Are there representations in Australian rock and cave art of things that are not familiar to us? I mean, for hand stencils and animals, you know, native animals, kangaroos and so on, yes. Are there images that are not familiar to us, or that we simply don't know? I mean, to use Wayne's argument that you sit and argue about what that image is?
Certainly there are. One of the most unusual that I've seen, this is in the middle of a remote part of Kakadu National Park. It's an animal, a four-legged animal, and it looks a bit like a thylacine, except that it has a head at each end, no tail. And it's like the Dr. Doolittle push me, pull me llama that has two front halves and no back half.
Yeah.
What's that painting all about? I've not seen another one like it, and it's a very well-preserved painting in one of the older styles, but obviously there was some amazing story that went with it, but we'll never know exactly what that is.
Just back on the techniques too, Joe, presumably these weren't painted willy-nilly or frivolously. I mean, they might have been frivolous. I don't know. We don't know. But the techniques that were used to put them onto the rock in the first place, given their longevity, were time-consuming, presumably, were they?
Yeah, well, we think so. Certainly, in some parts of the country, the geology is pretty hard, so making an engraving would take quite a lot of time.
Yeah.
Sydney region, however, John Clegg did some experiments and worked out you could actually make a large kangaroo probably in about 3 hours. He actually did some experimental things where he made little pits and then rubbed them together and worked out how many hours it would take to do a meter and all that sort of stuff. I mean, we haven't done that sort of experimental stuff everywhere to know, but certainly in the Dampier Archipelago, where I do a lot of work at the moment, the geology there is incredibly hard. And so to have created some of those motifs, which are very large and which are very intricate and very detailed, they have to have taken quite a lot of time.
Mm.
Other forms, other, you know, motif types are obviously not as detailed and wouldn't have taken as long. But if you're talking about a rock art province that's got over 2 million motifs in it, then obviously that represents a significant human effort and a significant human endeavour through a long period of time. And it gets back to your comment about, you know, continuity. And obviously things have changed significantly there, because when people first started living in the Dampier Archipelago, the coast was more than 100 kilometres away because the sea level was much, much lower. But then after the Ice Age, when the sea level came up, obviously it also tells a very different story to how people actually adapted to that landscape.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Just what about the issue of public publicity and access to sites? They're, you know, they're not in museums that close at 5 o'clock with security at the door. What do you think, Wayne, about this?
This is a real tricky one.
There are some people
one.
Who say, well, you know, they're part of our culture. I don't think you ought to be publicising them anyway.
Well, this is a tricky one. I think Paul and maybe Joe as well, we struggle a bit with, because, look, we want to showcase rock art to a certain extent, not inappropriately. Now, who is to decide what's appropriate and what's inappropriate? Mm. The fact is that we have sites where we keep closed. In other words, we keep the locations very secret. So when we record them and they go on the AHIMS, particularly in New South Wales, we have a system there that we can actually make it what's called a closed site. So there might be a square that might be 10 kilometres or 1 kilometre. So that's just a dot on the map. So to relocate that site will be very difficult, but it still comes up in the mix if you were doing research. So that can work really well. But there are a lot of people that I work with in the community that would prefer not the sites to be recorded, or if they were recorded, not to be put on a register of any sort. And they feel that's the best way to protect it. Now, there might be some merit in that, but from a heritage management point of view, particularly when you're talking about fire, if we don't know the sites and also too, if something happens to them and we don't have a good record, then they're gone.
Exactly. And if mining companies want to blow them up, if they're on a register, have some register.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, Paul?
Sometimes certain sites are made available for public access.
That's right.
In order to give people an experience, an educational experience, to learn about this key aspect of traditional culture and contemporary culture. And with the idea that the other sites in the area are closed off and we don't reveal their location. But of course, as researchers, we never publish the exact
location
the group references. But one of the problems that can occur is that these sites that are open to the public sometimes have inappropriate infrastructure that can lead to...
And that's where we need to really work, and Paul would agree with this, is where, in particular, the Sydney Basin, there's a lot of sites that get visited.
Exactly.
And there's no resources going in to looking after those sites at all. None.
No, and nothing to prevent
them. And I know that from my experience
with the
government agency that I won't mention.
What do you think, Paul and Joe? What's the best way to protect this? Because time has flown on us, but what do you think is the best way to try and conserve and protect it?
I think education is really, really primary in terms of just letting people know how important things are.
Yeah.
Because often people ignorantly, go to a place and they actually do see potentially some paintings there, but maybe they don't see them all, and then they think, oh, everybody else is writing their name here, I'll write my name here as well. But if you actually educate people into, how this art is not replaceable, and that if you damage it like that, it's actually been destroyed.
Mm.
Then I think that is the starting thing. But as Paul said, I mean, sites are opened up to the public and they're often considered to be the sacrifice sites in inverted commas because people want to be able to see things. They do need to have signage and interpretive stuff, but that does impact on the authenticity of a site. So going to a place that's got a boardwalk and signage isn't the same as walking out of a landscape into a rock shelter that's got a painting in it. But it's incredibly important that people can see rock art without impacting on it. Obviously, it's important to provide that sort of infrastructure in certain circumstances.
Unfortunately, some boardwalks have been made from wood or, in the worst cases, recycled plastic material. And when bushfires have gone through, they've ignited and in the process done a lot of damage. So that's something we need to be more mindful of in the future, is what sorts of infrastructure we put into sites to better protect them. And certainly I agree with Joe
that
education is the key, but also we need to better empower Indigenous communities and to give them the resources to better manage their rock art and to interpret it. Visitors.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. Well, I think I would definitely support what Joe and Paul have mentioned there. Education is really important. Accurate records are really important because it allows us then to assess the site, not just for the significance, because significance is quite an amorphous thing to a certain extent. I mean, we have guidelines, but more importantly, let's look at the site. What's happening to the site? Once you get the baseline study done, then anything that you do, any change is measurable. And I think that's the most important thing. And we need to work with our community and make it a holistic approach to conservation rather than just trying to do an intervention.
Chris has texted me saying, Chris, I think Chris is obviously from Tasmania, but as I mentioned, rock and cave art is present in every Australian state and territory, including Tasmania, of course. But as Chris says, this is a famous case, isn't it? There were massive petroglyphs stolen in Tasmania that just disappeared. I mean, they didn't disappear; they were chiseled off and stolen. There's an obvious case. Sorry, Joe.
Yeah. They were actually put into the museum. It was an intervention because they thought they were being destroyed by the waves at the edge of the beach. And so the museum actually cut them off and moved them.
It's incredible. A similar thing happened over on the Wakehurst Parkway too, and they're now in the Penrith Regional Gallery. I've had a look at them and recorded them, actually.
Yeah, they would have been under houses otherwise.
Exactly, Joe.
I do remember that one too.
Yeah, And so, look, I think, there's a lot of great people out there in rock art and there's a lot of willingness, but, the financially, it's really tough. It's tough for everybody, but I really strongly believe, and so do the people that I work with, particularly people like Graham King and Mully Arn, that we need to do something now. About this, and we really need to get constructive about it, particularly in the Sydney Basin. There's a lot more pressure on wilderness areas at the moment around the Sydney Basin, but in particular on some of the rock art sites. Some of them advertised still, and we probably need to rationalise this and work with the local Indigenous mobs that are here, that are interested, and get a more holistic approach to conservation here.
Paul, should we be seeing more of it in museums, do you think, or is this just a Western notion of trying to collect things?
No, one of the key aspects of rock art is its place in the landscape, and when you remove it, you sever that connection. With the Tasmanian example, the museum and the Tasmanian government is in the process of repatriating those engravings to the community. But there are some paintings, stencils, engravings in museums around the world. And they're like lost souls in a totally inappropriate place.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that point's probably well made. In the meantime, if you can get access to it and then you have permission to see it, you should try and do it. It is, I think, as we began this whole discussion, it was for me, and it has obviously been for our panel too, an emotional experience as well as a learning experience as well. Mm. So have a look at it. Our panel tonight has been Professor Paul Tayson, Griffith University's Chair in Rock Art Research. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe McDonald is the Director of the Centre for Rock Art Research and Management at University of Western Australia. Thank you, Joe.
Pleasure, Phil.
And Wayne Brennan's a Senior Archaeologist and Gamilaroi and Blue Mountains Community Member. And Wayne, thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
I tell you what, you have cool jobs, you people.
Thanks.
And important jobs.
We're very lucky.
We are very lucky.
Important jobs as well. Okay. Thank you for the discussion. Most interesting. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.